Welcome, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thank you guys once again for joining the 980s podcast hosted by yours truly, Kevin Thompson, founder and CEO of 980 Capital Group. Thank you guys for joining. As I always say, subscribe to the channel. As I always say, go and get my book, MLB to CFP, live on Apple and Amazon. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at info@990capitalgroup.com. Send us your questions. Go to the website at www.990capitalgroup.com. Schedule an appointment. As you know, we're here to do what? Educate, empower, engage, and also entertain. Follow us on all social media channels at 9iCap or at MLB to CFP. Today, we're talking to Jason Hsu, founder and CIO of Raliant Global Advisors. He's a phenomenal human being, and today we're going to be talking about China and the U.S. What's going on with all the tariffs? What's going on with all the trade? And if the U.S. is losing, who's winning? Dr. Hsu, welcome to the show. Let's get it. We are sitting here with a guy I've come to call a friend, Dr. Jason Hsu of Raliant. Man, it was a blessing and an honor to meet you at the Future Proof event. And again, man, thank you for joining the 980s podcast today, my friend.
Absolutely, Kevin.
So let's talk about this, man. You and I had this conversation. And first of all, Jason had a great presentation at the Future Proof event, and we're talking about the elephant in the room, China. And everybody's like, oh, China's taking advantage of us. We're in a bad situation. And I went up to Jason. I said, if we're losing, I don't know who's winning, because our stock market, we have six companies that are bigger than the Chinese stock market. That's part one. Part two, like, if we're losing, who's winning out there? People say it's China. I don't see it. So, Jason, let's just start there. That's my first question.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, like, if we're losing, who's winning in this? I'm throwing it to your direction.
Yeah, I mean, if, you know, basically 10x our wealth, right? Like, yeah, from 30 years ago when China entered the world and became this low-cost manufacturing center, yeah, at that time, our U.S. national wealth was $17 trillion. Today, it's 170. We 10x our national wealth, right? If that's okay, what losing looks like, boy, let me lose all the time, right? Sure, I mean, China's lifted itself out of poverty, right? Their national income's gone from like $300 a year to now $12,000. So they've done well for themselves. Yeah. But my God, the biggest beneficiary out of all this, out of this global trading, has been the U.S. There's no question about that at all.
Oh, how dare you say that? How dare you say that the United States is winning? Because every media outlet, well, certain media outlets, is going to tell you something entirely different. Hey, they're stealing our IP. You don't know what's going on over there. They're building these weapons for all of these different events. They're taking all of the steel. They are taking our manufacturing processes and use it to their own benefit. I liken it to this. I told somebody this a couple of days ago. I said, me blaming China, it's like my neighbor coming to me and saying, hey, can you fix my lawnmower? And I fix his lawnmower. And the next thing you know, I start selling lawnmowers. And they're like, hey, well, what the hell are you doing? I said, well, hey, I'm just taking over the whole market now, because I mean, again, I learned how it works. Like, I saw exactly how it worked. I can put it together and I can manufacture this process, and now I can just go out and build lawnmowers. But you're gonna get upset about me building lawnmowers and taking in all the manufacturing processes to do that? Again, I kid, but like, how are we upset about the IP theft and all the other stuff that's going around? Like, what's our explanation for that?
Well, I mean, you know, in economics, we call this transfer of technology. Now, yeah, you label it IP theft, you label what you want, right? I mean, frankly, yes, America does produce a lot of really important knowledge, right? Like, we, yeah, publish in papers, we teach it in universities. Like, yeah, I'm a university professor. I beg my students to come to class, learn something, remember it, and then go make money with it, right?
Yeah.
Yes, half of my students today in graduate schools are Asian, right? They're Chinese, they're Indian. For me to then say, that's IP theft, right? That's American knowledge. That's knowledge from me to you, and now you're making more money than me. That's a little ludicrous, right? Frankly, if you think about it, Americans have gone first to Japan, and we taught the Japanese how to make many, many things, right? We taught them how to make cars. Now Toyota is far bigger than GM and Ford added together. And then the Japanese went out to teach the Taiwanese, the South Koreans, and the Taiwanese went out to teach the Chinese. Yes, there's knowledge transfer from one level to the next, but always in our self-benefit, right? Like when Americans went to Japan to teach them how to begin manufacturing, we didn't do it out of the goodness of our heart, right? We want to outsource work to them because we don't want to do high pollution manufacturing work. And when we went to China and say, make iPhones for us, it's not because we want to give away free profits. It's because we want to tap into that low-cost labor. So we want to train them to be very productive, but very low cost, so we can keep all the profits, right? So you call that IP theft? No, it's a lot of IP transfer for the benefit of Americans, right? Because we want to move up the value chain and do something that's more innovative, more creative. That's R&D, right? We want the known, the rote, repetitive process to go to other people.
Dr. Su, you cannot say that. You cannot say that we exported our pollution. Don't you say that? Don't you say... Oh my
We
God, that's a lot of
can't,
people.
yeah.
A lot of
It
people don't
is probably
understand that.
one of the biggest hypocrisies, right? Like they say manufacturing is polluting. That's insane, right? Yes, manufacturing is polluting, but no one manufactures stuff for no good reason, right? You manufacture stuff because people want to buy it, want to consume it. So ultimately, it is the consumer that creates all the pollution. If you don't consume, people don't make. If you don't make, there's no pollution, right? The reason we have so much pollution is because we want to get a new car every 2 years. We get a new phone every 6 months. Is it necessary? I don't know, but it's certainly very polluting.
And you brought up an interesting point, my friend. You talked about, and this has been in the news lately, so we got to hit it. International students, U.S. competitiveness. What are you seeing there? Are there going to be, well, first off, why are we so upset with international students and coming to our country and making something of themselves? Isn't that the reason why we built the process the way it is? And by the way, they're paying full boat. They're not getting scholarships. They're paying full boat. So how is that bad for us?
Kevin, you're right on so many levels. So let me kind of start with like a lot of these international students, they come and study in the US. It's not like then they just take that knowledge and go somewhere else. Like most of them stay behind. The very best of them stay behind if they can find a job in the US, right? They become engineers at Google, at Amazon, at Walmart. They make iPhones. They do useful stuff and they pay taxes, right? That's really good for us, right? Like we're a country built on great immigrants who want, what this country has to offer and want to contribute and make it a better country. We shouldn't forget that. And then we're attracting the world's sort of best talent. And in fact, if you're in foreign countries, their governments worry about what? They worry about their brain drain, right? They spend 12 years training this amazing high school student, and then this high school student takes the SAT and comes and study in the US and stay on and contribute to the US, right? So it's a massive brain drain to foreign countries. It's actually a big problem for them. For us to say that's a problem for us is absolutely crazy.
I mean, so I guess what you're saying is what I guess what Americans are feeling is that we're putting all of this energy and effort in these guys, and even though, I mean, yes, some of them stay, but the ones that go and take it back, are we feeling some type of way that when a kid from India or China goes back to their own home country and wants to build a massive new company there and use the capitalist structure, quote unquote, to build these things. Like why would we be against that? Honestly, like is it not a good for the rest of the world?
I mean, it used to be one of the sort of key feature of American foreign diplomacy. We wanted international students, their best and brightest, to come learn, understand American democracy, understand the American way of doing business, understand capitalism. And then, if they take it back to their home countries, maybe they become a political leader, become a business leader. It, in some ways, indoctrinate foreign country into the American ways. right? I were to send to him the world. This is why everyone does their capitalism the way we do it. Everyone thinks they should become more like America. They should trade with America. Our brand premium is so valued by global countries because they've come and experienced it and they brought it back home and they've helped indoctrinate it and push it out for us, right? It's far more effective, you know, having them as our brand ambassadors than us trying to push American ideology on foreign countries. So it's great for us.
Yeah. By the way, loving the shirt, my man. Loving the shirt. That's what I'm talking about. We got a little baby. We got the babies coming out today. And I think this is powerful because what we've seen in the current market structure, we're seeing during our last bond auction, right? It was kind of bad, right? We have to call it what it is. I'm not sure if it was Japan, not sure if it was China. I don't know who stepped away from buying our debt, but it wasn't very good. So what do you think in regards to our currency? And we hear China talking about a digital currency and their initiative. And this may be a little bit kind of out of our purview, but I just want to get your opinion on this. Do you think the digital currency from a China or a US is going to be impactful? And how do you think from a cryptocurrency space, like how is all this going to work out? I know your brain's bigger than mine. So I know it's a big project and big problem, but how do you think this digital stuff going to work out with the United States dollar? Do you have any ideas around that?
Yeah. So Kevin, I will sort of decompose that question into two parts. I do want to talk about the bond auction.
Yeah.
Yeah, but everyone step back, right? It's the foreign governments who's historically been buying American bonds.
Yeah.
So they've stepped back because they're a little shell shocked, right? They feel like, hey, you know, anytime the U.S. is sort of irritated at them, you know, dollar can become a bit of a weapon. Like they could be selectively targeted for, you know, a default, right? It's like, hey, we don't like you, so we're not going to pay you. Right?
Sanctions, things like that. Yeah.
So they're not crazy to go, well, why would I lend money to someone who would turn around and say, oh, because you're a bad actor, so I don't have to pay you back, right? So, you know, foreign governments are not completely crazy, right?
Yeah.
Now, domestic investors are also stepping back because they look at our, government debt, right? $36.7 trillion going on 40. And they're thinking, well, is the government going to be able to pay this debt back or would just print more money and create inflation? If there's a lot of inflation, I want higher interest rates, right? So I think this is a lot of our own doing, both our domestic spending issues that we can't quite get under control and just the way in which we're dealing with foreign governments showing a little disregard for their sovereignty. So I think, you know, we got ourselves to blame there.
and not to mention, there's a big, beautiful bill out there that's not necessarily going to bring that debt down anytime soon, but go ahead.
but you know, you can't blame Trump, bro. You can't blame any president for wanting to spend money because, boy, you don't get elected president to then just make everyone miserable and take money away from them, right? So every president wants to be popular, wants to be well-liked, want to win the midterm election. So spending money is the obvious, easy solution. Can't blame the POTUS, right? That's just how it works.
Yeah.
So the point on cryptocurrency, right? You know, I gotta admit, right? Like, I am so far surprised by how big Bitcoin has become. So I've been wrong on that point, right? So I just want to confess to your audience, right? I'm still a skeptic, right? I think Bitcoin is like Tom Brady rookie card, right? It's like Michael Jordan rookie card. Yeah. It's like the Ohtani rookie card, right? Like, it has value. Because it's so interesting, right? There's scarcity. There is this fascination, but it is more a collectible than it is a actual currency. Okay, so I would kind of leave it at that, right? It is a fascinating collectible, but you know, I don't think cryptocurrency, at least where they are today, is gonna replace any global currency. Right? It is not gonna ascend and become dollar or gold. It will forever remain in this sort of main collectible interesting asset class, but not really ever a currency that would, you know, threaten the dollar or even, you know, a minor currency like the yen or euro.
What scares me about this whole thing is because it's not like we haven't seen this stuff before. Tulips, right? You have the tulips. You have all the stuff. I mean, and then you have people admitting, oh, I just made that coin up, whether it be fart coin, Dogecoin, just nonsense. 99% of this stuff's going to go away, and people are putting their money into it, which leads me to believe or feel that, like, why do we continually do this as human beings? Like, I don't understand the psychology. I mean, I understand the psychology of man. I just don't understand what we haven't learned from history, you know? And
Kevin, it's the fact that history rhymes, right?
Yes.
Must be because we don't learn from history, right? Otherwise, yeah. The same kind of mistakes, the same kind of Ponzi schemes shouldn't happen over and over again. Yeah. I think we men are just not great students of history, you know?
So we're in a trying time right now, because any given day, things will change. This is one promise about today's environment. One minute we have tariffs, next minute we don't have tariffs. How can we, as well, we're both kind of like business owners and all the other stuff, but in general, the small business owner, how can they run their business effectively in this kind of environment when you don't know what your input costs are going to be from a day to day? You don't know what downstream looks like. And it's like, well, hold on. You just told me that I had a 50% reduction, but now you have a 50% increase. Now with 25, 10, 50. It's madness, right? Or am I just overthinking this?
Kevin, you're right. It's sheer madness, right? Like, yeah. The reason we created the Fed and we say they got to manage, you know, price stability, right? Manage inflation is because you can't do business when you don't know what prices are, right? You don't know what prices you're going to sell for. You don't know what prices your input factors are. But what's crazy is our prices are relatively stable. We're creating instability by throwing unpredictable taxes on top of it. It's like, hey, taxes could be 30%. Maybe it'll be 80. Maybe it'll 134. Maybe it'll go down to 30 again, right? Like, prices itself isn't moving, but by changing taxes on the price, right, all of a sudden, everything, right, your costs and your profits are completely unpredictable. And when there's a lack of certainty, people stop consuming, people stop producing, people stop doing business, right? So this is a lot of self-harming going on.
A lot of self-harming, unnecessary self-harming, but I don't want to get people jumping down my throat, because we will get those, all the comments. We don't want to, hey, we're all love here, everyone. We're all love here. All right, a couple more questions. The active and passive debate, I know it's been big, especially over the last couple of decades. Like, why not just throw your money into an S&P fund and call it a day? But you're talking about investing in emerging markets and the active-passive debate there, and how active strategies like in China may be more beneficial. Talk to me a little bit around, like, what led to that shift a little bit? Like, what should investors, how should they approach those markets, and what should they expect?
Kevin, you know, as a university professor and the trustee at the CFA Research Foundation, like, I am the first person to say active versus passive. Hey, don't do active until you try passive, and unless you have a very, very good reason to go active, right?
Yeah.
Passive is just a great idea. Now, that is true, but I would say mostly in a very efficient market like the U.S., right, where there's so much competition, where the capital market is just so cutthroat, right? And it's professional managers, it's, you know, wealth managers like yourself who's been doing this, right, for a long time, right? But once you leave the U.S. and you look at, you know, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, China, India, where it's more than 50, 60% retail trading, I think in India and China, it's like 80, 90% retail trading, it is not a rational market, right? So there, if you're well-informed, you understand what you're doing, you can have an edge. Right. And so I think people shouldn't be too dogmatic about something, right? They need to understand when you go passive, when a market is fairly efficient, and of course, the U.S. can become inefficient, right? Like right now, like you said, lots of meme coins, right? Lots of crazy stocks, you know, Reddit.com with the Wall Street Bet, you know, websites, right? Like, you know, even the U.S. market can become inefficient. And you talk about global markets, like, very inefficient. So I think that's where you do want to shift away from passive to active. And another thing that people don't realize is when you're passively investing in a benchmark, like in the U.S., fine, sure, the S&P 500 is mostly just seven stocks, but these are at least seven great companies, right? And they're creating a lot of wealth, creating a lot of investor profits. But you go to foreign countries, their S&P 500 equivalent is top heavy with state-owned enterprises.
Yeah.
Right? With, like, gigantic conglomerate financial institutions that are hugely in bet with the politics and in many ways are used as the government's piggy banks, right? Like those indices, you don't want to invest passively in them because you're not going to get any growth. You're not going to really access the interesting creative companies that are creating value. So once you move out of the US, you also got to be super, super, cautious. And then I would say you should be very skeptical of the major indexes that they have available for passive indexing.
Well, my antenna just went up because you said something. And by the way, this is the era of the deep V. It's summertime. I got my chest hairs out a little bit over here.
If I have chest hair, I go deep V too.
No, but you said competition. And that in a perfectly capitalist market, Adam Smith, right? Yes. In perfect competition, profits go to zero. Everything like businesses go away and new businesses come in, but we're not seeing that. What we're seeing is larger companies killing the smaller companies or buying them up and getting larger and larger and larger, creating an oligopolist type of structure where it's just seven companies, like you mentioned, which are bigger than the entire index of the Chinese market. So, are we in a precarious situation where something needs to give, where we need to kind of bring back competition? Because I'm sure you've seen it in grocery stores. You go to a grocery store, oh, we got all this illusion. It's all an illusion of competition, but it's just four companies in there just putting all their products, right? So, in America, is that something we need to be cognizant of? Or is this like, no, this is just American exceptionalism?
Yeah, but absolutely, right? I mean, if you think about it, if you don't sort of break up monopolies, oligopolies, their market power will allow them to be bigger and bigger. Because why? Because they prevent competition. The reason they're
Yes.
able to get bigger, that their margins are exploding, right? I mean, Adam Smith says margins should explode because why? Fat margin attracts more competition. But that's only true if you allow the market to be competitive, right? If you don't let the big guys to just sort of use their market power, squash the little guys, buy them up, eliminate competition. So I think we gotta really wonder, hey, you have really amazing companies that are making record profits year after year. Has that been good for the consumers? Has that been good for the health of the entire economy? Or has that only been good for the founders and the shareholders of those companies? I think that's a question we don't ask enough. Sure, you're an investor in Apple, so you're super happy. Like Apple might be the only game in town. But at some point, you got to think about, hey, my phone costs $1,500. Is that right? With competition, could that go down to 500 a phone?
And then competition, collusion, market manipulation, it's all a part of the game. Dr. Sue, I got a couple more questions for you, if you don't mind, my friend. This has been phenomenal. Where are you located right now? That background, is that your background, or is that, this is beautiful out there.
It's my actual background. I live right by Boston Common, so I'm broadcasting to you from Boston right now.
Boo.
I know you're a
Boo.
Yankee,
No,
ex-Yankee.
hey, I'm gonna, well, Boston's a beautiful place. I'm not gonna sit here and lie. I enjoyed it while we're playing against the Red Sox and everything, but it's just not a place for me. I'm more of a New Yorker. I like the fast pace. I like the metro rails. I like all that stuff. Boston's just a little bit different for me. I don't know. I guess you got to get used to it. No.
Yeah, we Bostonians are significantly slower than New Yorkers.
Couple more questions, my friend, if you don't mind. So, China has a unique approach to innovation. So, in light of China's announcements in their AI and their tech, how do you evaluate the country's capacity for innovation compared to people like us? Like, you see they're stimulating their markets right now, outside of the real estate bust that happened, but they're stimulating their markets. I saw, by the way, full disclosure, I own some casino stocks in my portfolio because I follow them. Hey, don't laugh at me. No, but GGRA, the Macau came out with some great numbers today. Came out with some great numbers, so I was like, hey, this is
Yeah.
great. So, talk to me about AI and technology, the transitions, and them stimulating their economy, and how's that comparative to us?
China's come a long way, right? And so whenever I talk to people who have a view about China, I always have to remind them, I know you've been to China 20 years ago. You may have lived there, you may have worked there, you may have a lot of Chinese friends, but some of those Chinese friends left China 20 years ago, right? It's a very different place, right? The old model where it's just OEM manufacturing, right? It's low cost, right? There's no innovation. They simply, just imitate. Maybe they can do it cheaper, maybe they can do a larger scale because they have a bigger workforce. But that is no longer true, right? I mean, if you go to their factories are vast and large. Sure, they have 100,000 people working in the factory, but their factories are highly automated. It's just like it's the size of multiple cities. That's why they can fit 100,000 people doing important engineering work. But it's very automated, right? It's in many ways, from an engineering perspective, caught on and exceeded the US. And that's because we kind of delegate all the engineering work to them, right? And then practice makes perfect, right? They're doing a lot of engineering. We aren't, so they get better at doing engineering than we do. Hey, that makes sense, right? But they are also now starting to go into the creative, right? They're able to innovate. Again, not quite at the level that US can, but there's convergence. And again, you shouldn't be surprised, right? Whenever US says, hey, we're going to cut you off from some of the innovations that we have. So we're going to cut you off from the NVIDIA chips, right? We're going to cut you off from this and that. Well, then they have to go and innovate and figure out because they have engineering, but they need the advanced scientific discovery so the engineering can continue to move forward, right? So, sometimes innovation comes from necessity, right? We create a necessity and they'll innovate.
That's why Taiwan Strait is becoming such a rough area, my friend. You cut us off of those NVIDIA chips. We can go right over here and get some chips. You know what I mean? So that's and the last question I want to ask you, because I appreciate your time and I want to be respectful of your time, by the way. People like you see these things on the internet where people have been like I've had friends go to Japan recently. I've had friends go to China, and they come back and say, "Man, it's an economic marvel. It's clean. It's the way they run their cities and all the efficiencies and all the air and all the whatever." It's like, why? How is Japan? Again, I've never been there. So, I'm not sure the last time you've been or whatever. But how have
I'm
they
about to
gotten?
go in a week.
Okay, so. Yeah, so you better tell me what's going on. So how have they surpassed us, whether it be infrastructure and all the things they put in place? How are all these other countries surpassing us so much more quickly in regards to that? And they have social programs too. So like so what so why are we lagging behind so much? Or are we?
Kevin, sometimes it's the curse of being the first mover, right? In some ways. And I grew up in the US. I see myself as first and foremost American. So, I mean, we got to give a lot of credit to the US for being the first mover on many things, right? Because the rest of the world gets to sort of, right under your coattail and imitate what you have discovered, right? And also sometimes learn the lessons that you pay painfully for, right? And so yeah, I mean, US figured out many things. We make many, many mistakes, right? Let's just be honest, right? It's not like we did everything perfectly. We made a lot of mistakes, and some of the mistakes we're still smarting from, and some of the mistakes are probably too hard to fix. Other countries that come after us, right? Be it Japan, and later on, South Korea, Taiwan, and China, right? They get to learn and go, wow, hey, we can do it a much better way because the US sort of proven that out, or at least US proven out that is a bad way. So I think there's a lot of, value that we have created in the US that other countries can simply learn, imitate, and sort of capture that benefit. So yes, in some ways you call that IP theft, or you just call, hey, sensible people learn from other people's experience, right? And so they're just starting off from a higher level, so they get to where we've gotten to faster, and they can almost exceed that because they start off with a better blueprint, a better template, right, for that better future vision. So yeah, and I think a lot of it is really people drafting off of the US. And so we got to give the US a lot of credit. But I think the US should also then look at that and say, well, what can we learn from them, right? Because we don't have to always do the hard work and create everything ourselves, right? Other people have done some very amazing work, and we shouldn't always be so self-centered and think we're the very best, the center of the universe. It wouldn't hurt for us to look around and say, what can we learn from other countries? And I think there's plenty for us to learn.
Well, sometimes we feel like we got to put our boots on and our hats. Like We do it our own way. We're tech like you, I'm from Texas, man. And that's what we do in Texas. We don't give a damn if our grid works or not. We're just gonna be here in the cold, and we because we're the most powerful state and the most energy efficient state, and we're gonna do it our way. And the next thing you know, the lights are out. We're like, we don't give a damn because this is our way. You know, it's a Texas way. So, and then the Texas way becomes the U.S. way, and then we just want to put our boots on and just start stomping around and getting mad at everybody. But other than that. Man, I appreciate you being on the call today, helping us understand a little bit about China, helping us understand a little about global markets. I'm giving you the last word, my friend, because you're a fascinating man. I enjoyed our conversations, man. I enjoy now calling you a friend. What do you want to leave the audience with, whether it be China, whether it be our current economic landscape? Give them a few good words, lessons from Dr. Su.
Thanks, Evan. Well, the one thing that I want to remind everyone is no one is better at capitalism than America, right? So remember that. If we continue to let capitalism thrive, America will thrive more than anyone else. So when you think about free trade, America has won most from free trading. You think about the trade deficit we have against foreign countries. That is a misnomer. We are winning with that trade deficit because that trade deficit is just what? It's us, American, outsourcing things we don't want to do, things that other people can do a lot cheaper to help our companies make higher profit so we can create better jobs, right? That trade deficit is us winning, not us losing. So trust in America's ability to win the capitalism, right? If you keep letting us win the capitalism, we'll keep creating wealth. And the country will figure out how to create some wealth and income inequality as long as we keep making the pie bigger. And so do not doubt in America's ability to create greater wealth for all by allowing it to keep being great at capitalism. All right. That's all I got to say.
Well, and lastly, throw out your tags. Where can people find you?
I'm very easy to find. Find me on LinkedIn. My name, Jason Su. Just type it into LinkedIn and you can follow me. I have a regular newsletter called The Bridge, and that's where I talk mostly about sort of macroeconomic issues, a lot of sort of international politics. Hopefully it'll bring you a different perspective and help you see the world slightly differently.
Well, you absolutely helped me because those conversations we had at the Future Proof event, phenomenal. You're a fascinating human being, and I appreciate you having you on, my friend. And hopefully, we'll get to talk again soon.
Absolutely, Kevin.
All right. Today, we had Dr. Su and also Baby Wolverine and Baby Deadpool. But I want to really get serious here. The conversation we had today was fascinating, chock full of knowledge because we talked about China. We talked about what's going on in the global infrastructure of things, why the university students from international space, how that's impactful, and how tariffs and politics are playing a role in the small business. This is serious business, guys. This is something that needs to be addressed. As a small business owner, it's very difficult to run a profitable business if you don't know what your day-to-day input costs are. And that's what a lot of my small businesses I've been talking to have been dealing with. And then that becomes a domino effect down the chain. Thank you, Dr. Su, Jason Su of Ralliant Global Advisors, for joining the call today. Phenomenal human being. I appreciate his insight on China and what he has accomplished with the company he is with currently. Thank you guys for listening to the 90s podcast. Subscribe to the channel. Go and get my book, MLB2CFP Live on Apple and Amazon. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at info@99capitalgroup.com. Send us your questions. Go to the website at www.99capitalgroup.com. Schedule your appointment. As you know, we're here to do what? Educate, empower, engage, and also entertain. Follow us on all social media channels at 99cap or at MLB2CFP. Jason Su, thank you for joining us. Hopefully, this is the first of many discussions about what is going on currently. Phenomenal episode. That's all I'm going to say. Phenomenal episode. Stay tuned, my friends. More to come. Stay humble, stay safe. I'll see you again soon.